This is Breaking Down Security, and I am Brian Brake. Welcome back, listener. This is Brian, just Brian this week, on Breaking Down Security. For the majority of the U.S. American crowd here, it is Thanksgiving. And for the rest of the world, it's just Thursday. So happy Thanksgiving or happy Thursday. I gave everybody the day off. Well, Miss Berlin's actually in New Zealand attending B-Sides Wellington. And Mr. Betcher, of course, you know, he spends time with the family on the holidays like most Americans. So just thought I'd give everybody a week off. Going to do my own little thing here this week. I actually have about 25 minutes of audio from a fellow BrakeSec community contributor on our Slack channel. His name's JB. He went to a SANS Berlin conference, and he did some audio for us. So you're going to get to hear some of that after my little section here. I've decided to do a singular topic all my own that is fairly unique to, you know, what I do at work. So you're going to hear him talking about to Heather Mihalik, who taught the mobile pen testing class at SANS Berlin. So yeah, it was a really interesting topic of conversation. We don't normally take audio from community contributors or people who are not, you know, Mr. Betcher or Ms. Berlin. But you know, it was something new and different, and I thought we'd give it a try. So this seemed like a good time to put it out for everybody. So you'll hear that as soon as I'm done discussing my little topic here. So, well, okay. So the topic that I have is one that we all deal with on a yearly basis because, you know, it seems like a lot of our companies don't allow us to do so, and that's training. Training is one of those things that's kind of a necessary evil if you're dealing with compliance frameworks, or, you know, you deal with a lot of customers and they want to know that your people are, you know, getting regular training and that they're keeping up to date on either professionally, where you'd go to a SANS conference or SANS trainings or, you know, OSCP, or, you know, if they've got the necessary certifications like CISA or CISM, those kinds of things. Ours is this, what I'm talking about in training is like your annual security training, where, you know, you have a video that you watch that takes, you know, anywhere between 30 minutes to an hour. You might also pick that time of year to also do the sexual harassment training or anti-terrorism training if you were in the Navy or the armed forces, or ABC stuff, bribery stuff if you're, you know, overseas. All of these trainings are very important and they should be done, but maybe not all at one time. You know, you're sitting there watching something for 6 hours, and after a while it gets a little boring. And, you know, we do training at my office. Mr. Betcher and Ms. Berlin also do that at their office, presumably. But a lot of the complaints that I get, or the feedback that I get about our training, is that, you know, the one, we tell people to not, you know, install Flash on our boxes, but a lot of the LMS systems out there still use Flash. They don't use HTML5. You know, the videos appear to be outdated, like they discuss, you know, Windows, you know, XP or Windows 7, which isn't the newest content. They might also just, you know, mention that the UI is terrible, or it's not friendly to people who have disabilities, or, you know, the colors might not work for somebody who is colorblind in certain, you know, red-green colorblind. So some of these, you know, are very, very valid points, especially the ADA stuff. So, you know, it helps to... One, when you're building and finding an LMS system that they look at all of these things, that you're not using outdated technology, that the course material is updated semi-regularly. You know, UI is it's fairly subjective, I would think. Some people enjoy different types of user interface, you know, clicks versus, you know, interactivity versus just watching a video all the way through. So, I mean, a lot of the UI thing and the manner of doing training, you know, can vary from person to person. Then there's just some people who will not be happy at having to take training at all because it takes them away from their job because of the amount of time required to take these things. I actually sat through a sexual harassment training video when I was in the Navy that was almost 2 hours. You know, because they had actors going through scenarios and then, you know, it would pause you and you'd have to answer questions. And it wasn't like something you could put in the background, which is what a lot of people do, and just let the video run while you listen to the audio. it really depends on the type of training and the type of content that's being, you know, delivered for that. So we at my office started something new, and to be honest, it was probably because I have my show here and I am fairly comfortable speaking on a microphone. So I made the suggestion that why don't we make our own training? And there was some resistance because, you know, most people are like, well, what are we going to talk about? What, you know, how are we going to get this uploaded to the system? And, you know, what format is it going to be in? You know, so I came up with the idea of creating training that was one, topical, two, not very long, and, you know, in keeping with the guidelines of the environment, and even allows us to tailor it to certain groups of people. So the way I've been doing it is, and the way we're doing it at work now, is creating small topics of conversation. Like I created one for working in coffee house. So a lot of our people at my office work remotely, and you know, they go home, like they may be sitting at Thanksgiving or Christmas, and they may get called into work. You know, they have to work remotely, so they have to understand ways to work in a secure environment. You know, you don't, I started the whole process of this by one, creating a general idea of the topics I wanted to discuss, kind of like how I do a podcast. I set up a Google Doc and, you know, just started brainstorming things that I might want to discuss about how to work remotely, more securely while being working remotely. So, brought up a couple of scenarios, like one, working in a coffee house, and two, working at an in-law's house, or let me see, where was the other place? Just working in a public area. So I came up with the idea of three random, not random, but three general places that most people would, you know, work if they weren't in a typical office, like, you know, you were having to go into the office, or if you work remotely, you know, places you wouldn't normally feel comfortable doing. So I work in my house, you know, 95% of the time. So if I decided to take my work laptop and go to a Starbucks, for instance, I go into a Starbucks, every Starbucks is a little different. So, you know, I tried to explain best ways to, you know, keep your information safe from people who are like, who may shoulder surf on you, or, protect you against, you know, viewing remotely. So, you know, I mentioned things like making sure you sit with your back to the wall, making sure you, you know, use screen protectors, make sure that you, don't leave your laptop out when you go pick up your drink or you go to the bathroom. You know, don't leave your machines unattended. Lock your machine when you're not, you know, using it, you know, and you're not sitting at the box. Those kinds of things are important and may not always be in a typical InfoSec training. So we've also done other ones about, you know, creating secure passwords. Also, I've got one coming up about securing your home Wi-Fi. You know, these things may not be, you know, high-end, you know, here's how you reverse engineer binaries or whatever, but for the typical office worker or the typical employee, these are very topical things that could affect them. And that's the important thing about the InfoSec training. You want to tailor it to your audience. We also are creating training for just developers and for just salespeople. Like, we have a track for what happens if you are at a sales conference or at an InfoSec conference. Salespeople who are, manning a booth at a conference, the security there is going to be way different. You don't want them connecting to hotel Wi-Fi. You don't want them connecting any kind of Wi-Fi other than maybe like a mobile Wi-Fi access point or something like that. We create these customized trainings for salespeople, developers, engineers, even training for our own IT and InfoSec staff as a way of getting them training that is topical to them and keeps them interested. So let me see. How do I make it? All right. So I've got my show notes here. So I'm just going through. How do I make it work? Okay. So the point is, you want to, instead of have a 2-hour video about, all the different topics, you want to kind of break those up into, I would say, anywhere between 5 to 7 minutes, no more than 10 minutes for a video. And, I wouldn't say have it strictly scripted, but I would definitely have some kind of generic plan as to what you want to do. And a lot of that can be done by doing the con slide thing, where you have, when you go to a conference, everybody has con slides for their talk. They slide through them and they brief them as they go along. So what I do is, for a 7-minute talk, I try to create at least 4 to 5 slides that have points on them that I can talk to. And you're probably going, well, Brian, this is an audio podcast. Why are you creating, visual content for this? And my thought is, well, you want to do what's called screencasting. And what screencasting does is allow you to take video of your slides while you're briefing them. And by doing so, you can create training that is useful. So the important thing is to remember that you want to do topics that are for your intended audience, which would be, engineers, IT, or what have you. But you may also want to do them on a timely topic. Let's say you've done a recent phishing campaign, and you may want to create some short training that would highlight why you did the training. So let's say you've put out a phishing campaign, and 25% of your employees clicked on the links and were successfully phished by your campaign. Well, you might want to be able to explain to them how they got phished or where they could have looked to make sure that they, don't get hit by that again. So you may create a video these topics, using slides, like I said, no more than 10 minutes, 5 to 7 slides, for a 10-minute talk, and spend no more than like a minute and a half on each slide. And by the time you do that, you'll find you have about 10 minutes of audio. So when you're doing the video, there's some built-in software that you can use for screencasting and showing the video of the slides and you talking to them. For Windows folks, I'm afraid you don't really have a screencasting software available to you, but you can download something called Screencast-O-Matic, which we have a link in the show notes to. The free version is 7-minute long videos, which is more than enough for what you need to do. And you'd be surprised how quick 7 minutes goes by. So, you want to make sure that your topic is, fairly narrow for 7 minutes. If you're using Apple or OS X, there is a QuickTime has the ability to allow you to record your desktop and do screencasting. It does save it as a fairly large video file. So what you'd want to use is something like Handbrake to convert it down to a smaller MP4 or a Matroska MKV file. You can use a Handbrake for any of these things to turn them into a standard format. I would suggest MP4 or Matryoshka, only because your MKV files, your MP4 files are, you know, good. Don't try to make AVI files and WAV files and MP3 files and, you know, WebM files or what have you. You want to stick to specific guidelines. And the only thing that should really cost you any money on this, because, you know, training costs money for the most part. One, if you've got an LMS that allows you to upload your own content, that's always a good thing to remember. The other thing is you might want to invest in some decent audio microphones. You know, you can use your internal mic on your Mac or your laptop, but the audio quality will, it could suffer depending on where you're located, because those can tend to get echoey at times. You know, those are always good. If you know, training shouldn't have to cost a ton of money. You can actually just, you know, you don't even need an LMS, to be fair. I mean, the only reason you would need something like that is if it records who all has done it. So if you say, well, the whole company has to do this, you know, by clicking on the link, you record, you know, that you've actually viewed the video or what have you. And those might be the only reason you would have to do that. But for a small business or a small organization of less than 50 people, I don't see any reason why you couldn't just upload it to a wiki or to, you know, to your intranet pages or something, and then, you know, have them email it out to you. So training doesn't have to cost a lot of money. Just remember that. You don't have to spend, you know, $8,000 to $10,000 for custom content when you have people in your own organization who could probably do it for you for not very long, you know, not very much time or effort. And by doing so, I think you get a better product in the long run, because, you know, it adds a personal touch. You know, if everybody's, oh, hey, that's Brian from, you know, the InfoSec department, or, hey, that's Dave. Hey, Dave, great video, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, if you can get other people in the organization to help you create that training, it makes it a bit more personalized. It makes them think that, you know, there's a bit more caring involved than just, you know, throwing some random thing that, you know, may or may not, you know, fit for your organization. If it's coming from people inside the company, they know that these people know what they're talking about, and they can be used to, you know, it's going to matter to them. Whereas something generic may not matter. So yeah, that's what I came up with. You know, we have a lot of options out there. If you, you know, have any questions about how to create your own training, please let me know. Technically, I guess we do this with the podcast. It's kind of like a training thing every week. So, yeah, if you have any questions, I mean, it can get expensive. I mean, microphones and mixing boards and whatever. Don't get crazy with that. Just, you know, do whatever. You know, do whatever's cheapest and whatever works and gets you a, you know, fairly decent audio quality. It's not supposed to be polished. The idea is it's supposed to be kind of rough. I think people found a lot more value out of my rough interpretation of a video versus something we may have paid more money for. So. All right, that's all I got. I'm going to go and have me some turkey and some pumpkin pie. Actually, pumpkin cheesecake my wife made. So after I get done talking here, JB will be on. He added some production value. He added some background music. He did some voiceover stuff. So I actually suggested he turn this into a podcast of his own, because he's overseas. He's not in the U.S., and I thought that'd be a great, you know, way to start a podcast. That's what we did. So when we first started back in 2014, we went to a SANS conference, got interviews with Kevin Johnson and a bunch of other folks, and started the podcast from there. So I suggested he do the same thing. So maybe he will. So if you want to contact the show, you can contact us at BrakeSec, BrakeSec on Twitter. Ms. Berlin is at InfoSister, InfoSystir, and Mr. Betcher is at BetcherPwned, BoettcherPwned. And you can, I guess you can follow me at Brian Brake, BryanBrake. And we have a Patreon. If you found value in this podcast or any of our other ones, we have about 200 hours worth of audio. Please feel free to leave something in the tip jar. We're on iTunes, Google Play Store, player.fm, TuneIn Radio app, soon to be on Spotify, hopefully. And, we're on iTunes, so please leave us some feedback if you use iTunes. We'd appreciate that. And, we have a massive Slack channel. So if you want to sign up for Slack channel, we have a bit.ly link for that, which it's breaksec.com/breaksec. So, feel free to, get on that. So have a great Thanksgiving, or if you're not in the U.S., have a great Thursday and the rest of your week, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Hey, it's JB. I'm an information security professional here in Berlin, Germany, an American citizen, and I was fortunate enough to attend SANS Berlin conference. And I asked Brian, I'm a big fan of the Breaking Down Security podcast and what Brian and Amanda do with that. And I'm on the Slack channel, when we have people that want to talk about the book club, I also host the European call for the Breaking Down Security book club, which that's why I'm saying this right now. Join us and join the Slack channel. So I hope you enjoy these clips. Most of them are anonymous, but I definitely can say that you're hearing a few odds and ends here from some of the top minds in Europe, if not the whole world, about the topics at hand: mobile device management, cell phone forensics, bring your own device, and you'll hear a little bit of me joking around with my network forensics class as well. And what's really, really funny is that in the first segment, when you hear us talking about teams and the Ned Wars, we actually did make a team, me and the gentleman you hear, and we did win the team competition, so I'm pretty proud about that. And there's a link in the show notes with the little blog I wrote about it. So thanks, hope you enjoy. Okay, I'm here now. Oh, I just dodged a very important question about my name. No.
Yeah.
So I'm here with two of the participants from SANS in Berlin. And are we going to joke anonymously, or do you want to really tell them who you are or like what you do or something?
We are security aware.
Yeah, privacy is better.
Okay, awesome. And I was going to say, are you ready for the capture the flag tomorrow?
I hope so.
Yeah, hopefully. We've learned a lot the past few days, so we're better off than at the start.
But I hope that I will be in a team with JB.
Yeah.
Then everything will be better.
This is where I'm going with this question. See, okay. I heard from someone else that does the podcast that it's very important to recruit people that will win on your team.
Ah.
One of the main people on the podcast, I will just not say who, but it's a joke for them later.
Okay.
Well, what would you say is the most fun part besides learning of being? Is it
the
important?
People you meet?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really great. Other, well, kind of different, but also like-minded people.
Yeah, I like to speak with people of the different nationalities, and it's interesting to see how some laws can really restrict one. For example, in Germany, it's really interesting.
Like the what's it called, the Datenschutzgesetz.
Yeah, I have no idea how it's called.
Oh yeah. Oh,
but
right.
It's interesting because, for example, in Holland we can quite easily store some packet captures or something when we have consent, and in Germany it's probably harder. So it's, yeah.
You always have to involve your legal department to make the right things.
We don't have a legal department. So.
We have heard that in our class a few times, something like shoot first, ask questions later, unofficially. Do you think it's easier to meet people in Europe at something like SANS, or maybe, I don't know if you've ever been to America to a big conference. For me, it's very difficult when I go to a large event to meet people. But here I feel really, really comfortable, like everyone is kind of same, shy, you can just, everyone can talk with each other and be shy together.
I've never been to the US to a really big conference, so I went to another SANS event that was a bit bigger than now, but it was the same kind of feeling, like here.
I haven't been to another conference of SANS, but I can imagine that because it's just a little bit smaller, it's easier to talk to some people, also of other courses and stuff. Mm-hmm. But it would be a really large crowd, so I would probably stick more to the same people.
Yeah, some I told them earlier on this podcast that some of the American events have 1,000 people, and they don't even have a party. Here we have free drinks, we party every night.
Yeah, it's Berlin, so you have to party.
Yeah. Maybe I do one more question before we go back to packets. What do you think, for a serious comment, any? What do you think is number one important security topic for you next year?
For me?
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a good one. I think about it.
Or your organization, which at this point is anonymous anyway, okay. So.
So, security operations center for me. Yeah. The monitoring of events, correlation of log events, but even after that, when we kind of get the right alerts and no false positives or few false positives, really handling the incident until the conclusion that everything is solved and we know, okay, something did happen or something didn't.
Yeah.
That will be... Yeah, kind of on the agenda for next year.
So building a better SOC with open source tools or?
No, commercial.
Getting lots of phone calls.
Yeah, that too.
Good news.
Okay. I think that there are probably many technical things we could improve that we know, but actually I think the most important part for us is that sales don't sell everything that is new. We have too much customers. And so you cannot do the important stuff because you're always doing the things that has to be done today. But at the same time, you really have to invest in some research and in improving other stuff. So that's... Yeah.
Comes back to prioritization and everything.
Yeah.
For me, it's probably discouraging password reuse. The technical things, Chin, at this time are the... Maybe, I don't want to say easy, but that part is kind of up to me and not a lot of oversight, but the password reuse is going to be the victim, and I don't want anyone to find out the hard way that Macs don't get viruses. So.
Yeah. You can enforce this, of course. I have to renew my password every 1 or 2 months. It's really annoying, but it works. Half.
For us, it's every 3 months. But we also have, additionally to that, two-factor authentication. So if you kind of forgot to renew your password, you also can fall back to that. That's really good.
Well, thank you for chatting with me. Oh, I'm here in Berlin at the SANS event with a very special guest. What's your name, sir?
Bobby Tables.
Oh, is he related to Bobby Skulls?
No, I'm related to the Bobby Squirrely Brackets Tables, my NoSQL cousin.
Yeah, of course, no SANS, we always have a lot of fun, and we got all of our tables straightened out here. And so it's day 6, so it's time to get home.
Yeah, exactly. And we tried to infect the Windows hosts with the Bad Rabbit.
Bad Rabbit, but sadly, Bad Rabbit went bad and just blew up the host.
Bad Rabbit does not rock hard enough for Bobby Tables.
No.
Thank you very much. The room with the aquarium. Yeah, so what do you think about bring your own device?
Well, I was going to ask you the question because it suddenly just came up in conversation.
Where I work... And-
this bring your own device is widely implemented, but I don't allow people with Microsoft Windows to be on the main network. They have to be on a guest network. Yeah.
I think, so starting from not a security-specific standpoint here, more of a privacy one, because that's appropriate, we're in Germany. My argument, I don't mind if the company wants to do it that way. You can probably do it in a somewhat secure way. You can have some MDM or whatever. But as an employee or as someone who owns a phone and has a personal phone, I don't want to bring my personal phone in for two main reasons into my work life. Right. First reason, it's easier to bother me. It's easier to not have my work phone on me. You know, if I'm going around the place, and then that can be a reason that the email has to wait. And I think sometimes that's a good discipline thing. You know, sometimes it's good to physically put the work stuff away. But secondly, it gives them the ability to take my phone and at least say, oh, we will just look at the things that are to do with work. I mean, I've done this enough because I do traditional forensics cases that I see it probably crop up, you know, every month or two, this exact scenario where someone has to give a personal device to their company and have some forensic guy go over it with a fine tooth comb.
Yeah,
and look at the most inner details of the private life, and that just doesn't have to happen. It can still happen if, you know, maybe they can still go after your personal device if they think you've done something wrong or stolen some data or whatever. But it makes it's very hard for them to do that. Whereas it's very easy to do it if you've already given it to them and they've, you know, signed in. You've signed into Exchange or whatever it is on that phone. Because you literally sign a document, right?
Right.
So like, and on those grounds alone, I'm just completely against the idea.
So everyone has given a nice excuse here to tell your, you know, fellow coworkers, you don't want to bring your own device. Just forget about that policy.
Yeah. I guess it can probably be convenient for both sides.
But it's
convenience. There's a point where it doesn't kind of supersede those concerns, I think.
Are you the one that has to monitor that, or someone else would have to monitor that?
Oh, you mean monitor what?
The traffic.
Exactly as well. Yeah. But no, it's more about just. I think it's a separation argument. I have on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of people will talk immediately about mobile device management. So, like, how do you pass the profile or whatever?
And right. Yeah. And I assume if you do bring your own device, I don't actually know, maybe you can tell me. I assume you're allowed to mostly use the phone in the way you would. I'd hope so, because it's your phone. But then also, every time you use your phone, maybe you're wondering in the back of your mind, okay, like, what would this look like? To be honest, it's a very forensic, traditional forensic kind of outlook on this. You're kind of always thinking about the scenario where a phone's been imaged and what that might look like to someone.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and I think bringing your own device pretty much rules out the most secure scenarios unless there's a profile involved of some kind. So,
I was going to say, like, if you're doing it in a kind of very laissez-faire way of just like, okay, yeah, just log in, then that's just crazy for a whole load of other reasons. So, yes, I suppose you're right. Like, everything I'm saying is under the assumption that it's a proper MDM, kind of getting deployed out and signing kind of agreements about how the device is getting used. I don't know. What do you think?
Well,
I want to know what you think.
For me, that's pretty much it, because I'm lucky enough that I get to implement the security policies at an organization that necessarily doesn't have a great reason to be secure other than to protect intellectual property and just to protect everyone's devices in general. But if I was in an environment that for some regulatory or compliance purpose you needed to be secure, I think I wouldn't allow it at all, which is, that's the standard around the world, isn't it? Is that true? I guess that's my final MDM question. Is that true that it just wouldn't be allowed, or is there products?
Well, no, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, to this day, there's a lot of people talking about that, you know, in security community, but also like a lot of lawyers and compliance people, regulatory people, obsessed with whether or not it's a good idea. And like, so I mean, it really will depend who you ask, because to be fair, a lot of these people deal in a world of competing, and again, it's the competing interests and the balances of trying to keep people happy and having a sensible policy that's workable versus something that, you know, is like a draconian and will never work. Because of course, that this latter example just falls apart, and it's like the least good way of doing it. if you do something that's, you know, too, you know, it's, it requires too much of the users or the company or whatever. But I've not seen anything that really convinces me it's worth the effort.
Yeah.
And again, for the reasons I was saying, again, I'm coming from a,
yeah,
a kind of anti sort of perspective.
So we have 30 seconds left. Any quotations for what is the very most important information security topic of the next 6 months?
Ooh.
30 could seconds be, left.
Could be, as in you think what will crop up?
Mm-hmm. Just sort of, when you meet smart people, you always want to ask them, what do you think is important tomorrow or in 25 years?
I'll remember to ask them when I see them.
Yeah, exactly.
I would like to think it would be something like passwords or something, i.e. getting rid of passwords.
Completely.
Yeah, because I'm interested in when that's going to happen. It's going to happen at some point soon, but maybe not that soon.
Yeah.
People are going to start, you're going to start seeing genuine, proper authorized, and I guess to be fair, like Apple is probably the closest to going down this path properly with, you know, their newest devices.
Right.
But, you know, like an actual death of passwords is... I'm interested to see how that goes.
I answered this question earlier with password reuse. This is exactly my answer, but that was not as specific. So, thank you very much then. And we get on with the festivities here.
So in this last segment here, I was really lucky and got to speak with Heather Mihalik on the final day. And we lost the very beginning of the interview where we did the introductions. So we have her links to her book she mentions and her blog in the show notes. And I'm sure that Brian will pass those on. And I really hope that this leads to another interview full length with Breaking Down Security for Heather. What we were talking about right as you cut in here is just that our services like WhatsApp that everyone uses, even though we know that they're not completely secure, at least they've had a history of problems, or for example normal text message, cell phones, are these services the assumed breach, so to speak, of cell phones? So Heather's a cell phone forensic expert, and I'll let you hear what she has to say.
I was actually going to bring up the recent HTTP link thing that was publicized, where the HTTP link starts transmitting text and clear text on the network, even though the rest of the chat is encrypted. Am I verbally describing that correctly?
You are, and honestly, I will be brutally honest here. So I'm currently taking Phil's FOR 572 class on demand right now, because that is my weakness. So that's why I rely on him. And if anyone's interested, we've done a talk, Peas and Carrots, together, where it's smartphone and network forensics go together like peas and carrots.
Wow.
And it's out on my website, Smarter Forensics, and you can look at it there. But that's my current weakness.
Network.
Yes.
The intersection between network and
I know. It's my weakness. I'm like, it's not my thing.
I wanted to give you a chance to promote the book. Did you say it's the fourth book?
No, there's two. They're writing a third, but... this probably sounds terrible. I opted out.
Okay.
So there is a third edition coming out. I don't know. I just feel like with mobile, it's hard. By the time the book is released, it's kind of dated. So I just prefer to blog for free now. That's just my new MO. Do things for free.
Yeah.
You can buy the old ones if you're interested. And actually, the first edition, Practical Mobile Forensics first edition, was very difficult to write because we tried to do strictly open source tools for smartphone forensics. It is almost impossible. It is so hard to do that. The second edition, we introduced commercial tools, but more the best tools for the job. So it's Android, iPhone, Windows Phone, and BlackBerry. And then a whole section on third-party applications and databases.
And so it's safe to say that the proprietary tools are really, really important for smartphones.
Absolutely. But the issue is you need to know more than the tools. So you... what I try to help people do is know how far they can take their case in the tool before they have to branch out and do it on their own.
Right.
So what to trust, what not to trust.
Yeah.
And always trust but verify.
And for the programmers out there, are there any good tie-ins to the programming world? with smartphones, or is that learn your assembly language, and how do you get into, let's say, reverse engineering the protocols?
A lot of the data is SQLite databases, so that's okay. Pretty easy to break down. Most of our decompiling is Java, so it's nothing really different than what people are used to seeing.
Okay. So maybe that will inspire some others to get out in the forensic world of mobile.
Yeah, and I wrote a blog today on my toolbox, and it includes everything from the fancy $14,000 tools to the awesome scripts that people in the community have written that help us every day.
Yeah.
So I just break it down from top-notch commercial tools to everyday scripts that I rely on.
Yeah. So we have the really nice hotel music turning up and about to enjoy our drinks. And I have one last question for Heather here, and that is, what do you think will be the number one thing you will work on next year, or maybe the number one topic for people in your field, in mobile forensics?
I'm thinking encryption with Android Oreo. And when the horrible iOS 12 comes out, I'm already dreading it. I love the iPhone, and I'm getting the new one, but iOS 11, it wreaks havoc on my life when it's released. So I dread mid-September every year because people expect the impossible before it's even occurred.
So everyone,
which is crazy. So they want you to have the answers the day and the second it's released.
Wow. So look out for 11, is that right?
Looking for more iOS 11, Android 8, Oreo, and all of the hard thing with Android 7 and 8 with Nougat and Oreo is using applications simultaneously and trying to associate the metadata to actually what's in use.
Right.
And that's huge with accident reconstruction, when people are trying to say for an insurance company if someone was on their phone or not.
So if someone's running unpatched, not current Android, is that pretty much just a piece of cake to crack it? Okay.
That's our dream.
Must be current.
Yes. Google Pixel. The most popular version of Android is still 4.4.
Wow.
It's wild. Because the manufacturers don't let you update after a certain point in time.
Exactly. Yeah. Great. So thanks for talking. And how can people reach you? They can look up your bio, Heather Mihalik. And also on Twitter, you are at
Heather Mihalik.
Heather Mihalik.
Pretty boring.
Same. Yeah, and I'm at CherokeeJB on Twitter, and I follow Heather. And yeah, check out the podcast, breakingdownsecurity.com. Join our book club. And thanks a lot. See you.
Thank you.